Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on taxes when we come back. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms, but what is it that government is doing for us to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for the price of a beer, or 72% out of the price of a drink? Now, does the guy in the pizza parlor make 38% profit on that pizza that they have to buy the ingredients to make, prepare, cook, serve, and then pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? And why is it the government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that you and I buy? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. Our school, Tax and Status, is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, last time we were talking about this thing of George W. Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev. I said that we Americans have adopted communism like we invented the stuff. And not only have we adopted communism, the Russians and the Chinese have not adopted the Ten Commandments. I don't know what the battle in the Cold War was all about, but I thought it was a war, a battle of ideas, of principles, of beliefs, of political ideology. And if that, in fact, was the case, then the communists and the Russians and the Chinese won the Cold War hands down. Hands down. I know America gets credit for winning the Cold War. I have to chuckle every time I hear that. I wonder, what was it that we won? You know, right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, their economic debacle over there, we rushed over there and started sending them money. Now, in ancient times, when one side won a war, they made the losing side pay them reparations or pay them tribute or pay them money. And so right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I noticed the United States was rushing over to Russia, and we were paying them tribute, and we were paying them money. And it made me wonder. I said, well, when did this turnaround come about? When did the winners pay the losers? I thought it was the losers that were supposed to pay the winners, didn't you? So when I see America sending money to everybody in the world, it says to me, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure that we're on the winning side. Now, essentially, our military and other resources are being used by the CFR, the globalists, as the spearhead of this New World Order, not as global Pax Americana, as there is nothing American about it, but as an extension of the old Soviet model of communist expansionism. And this is to lay the foundations by force for a one-world government under a socialist United Nations administration. And that is core of the Bush Doctrine. It was George Bush Sr.'s agenda, and it is the agenda of all of the globalists at the top levels, and George Bush Sr. admitted as much in the following statements. Here's George Bush Sr. He said, "We will give Gorbachev our assurance that America welcomes this reform, not as an adversary seeking advantage, but as a people offering support. I will assure him that there is no greater advocate of perestroika than the President of the United States," George W. Bush Sr. And he went on to say, "It is the sacred principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter." Did you get that? I'm going to underline that for you. Sacred principles. I haven't heard any politician call the Ten Commandments sacred or the law of God sacred, but I see the sacred principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter, to which the American people will henceforth pledge their allegiance. I thought we pledged allegiance to the United States of America. Now I find out George Bush Sr. wants me to pledge my allegiance to the United Nations. That was George W. Bush, by the way, addressing the United Nations General Assembly in February. That's February 1st, 1992. Bush's comrade, Gorbachev, admitted that communism would never go away. It would never go away if he could help it. And that perestroika was a mere cover for merging the United States and Russia under Leninist socialism. And here's what Gorbachev said. He said, "Gentlemen, comrades, do not be concerned about all you hear about glasnost and perestroika and democracy. In the coming years, they are primarily for outward consumption. There will be no significant internal changes in the Soviet Union, other than for cosmetic purposes. And our purpose is to disarm the Americans and let them fall asleep." Mikhail Gorbachev in a speech to the Soviet Politburo in November of 1987. Boys and girls, the collapse of the Soviet Union. All of this hoopla that you heard about communism being dead and America winning the Cold War is just so much propaganda to get you to go to sleep, so that you can be merged into the New World Order. Now, is communism dead? If communism died in the USSR, then there ought to be established criteria, fingerprints, by which we could identify this political corpse. So what are they? And where is the evidence? So let's turn to the Communist Manifesto. Remember those 10 planks? Their political agenda, and see whether communism received a decent burial or simply adopted an alias called democracy to beguile the unsuspecting victims of a growing tyranny. First of all, was it gleefully announced by an anti-communist media that the USSR abolished its property tax, thus restoring absolute allodial ownership of land to the peasants? Well, if it wasn't, then the first plank to the Communist Manifesto was alive and well in Russia, which calls for, by the way, the abolition of property and land and the application of all rent of land to public purposes. No, sir, boys and girls, the communists have not abolished the first plank to the Communist Manifesto in Russia, and they have exported it, and we have accepted it here in the United States in place of the Eighth Commandment that says, "Thou shalt not steal," and Leviticus 19:35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25:13-16, which tells us not to have unjust weights and balances in our bags. And we use Federal Reserve notes, boys and girls, and every means of commercial paper, along with our central bank. Now, did your newspaper announce and applaud the eradication of income taxes in the USSR? Did you hear about income taxes being abolished in Russia? Well, if you didn't, then the second plank must still be intact. That calls for a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. Remember that? We have that here in the United States, you know. I think you people down in Australia and New Zealand have it. And I'll bet you Canadians have it, and you Western Europeans certainly do practice the second plank of the Communist Manifesto with this heavy progressive income tax. Number three, Have your glossy magazines, you know, U.S. News and World Report and Time and Newsweek, told you about how the Soviets repealed the inheritance tax? They didn't? Well, I'll be. Then those poor peasants still can't convey their hard-earned labors undiminished to their offspring, and neither can you, because you have an inheritance tax in your country where you live. The inheritance tax. That's a part and parcel of communism. That's not a part and parcel with the inheritance statutes of the Scripture. God never taxed us a penny on the transfer of our wealth to our sons and daughters. And number four, what about the Soviet directive stating that the IRS, or is that the KGB, would no longer levy people's wages or ransack and pillage their homes? Hey, you're kidding. It wasn't in your Sunday paper either. Remember, the fourth plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for the confiscation of the property of all immigrants and rebels, those that are fleeing the system. Remember? And number five, have you read in any of our papers about Russians? About how in Russia that the trusty reporters that we listened to spoke of the Soviet plan to recall their funny money, return the people's gold and silver, and foreclose upon the banks? Now listen, the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto calls for a central bank, and they didn't repeal the central bank in Russia, but they exported the central bank to the United States. And we have a central bank over here that issues our money in opposition to just weights and balances. It looks like to me that the Russians have not accepted just weights and balances in Russia, but they have exported communism to the United States and we've adopted it. The Russians don't adopt the Ten Commandments, but we adopt the central bank. The Russians don't adopt our Bill of Rights, but we adopt the Ten Planks. Now, does that sound like to you that we won the ideological conflict called the Cold War? And if we won, what did we get? Number six, was anything said about the restoration of one's right to use his own car and the people's right to use the news or the airwaves without a license? Well, how about the unregulated right to communicate freely? No? Remember, that calls for the centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. And have you been paying attention how the state, the United States government, is listening to your emails and listening to your telephone conversations, and they're getting all the big wire communications, you know, like AT&T and the telephone companies to turn over their records of your telephone calls? Does that sound like the sixth plank to the Communist Manifesto to you? That's what it sounds like to me. And they do that in Russia, and they do that in China, and they do that in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and every country of Western Europe. Doesn't sound like to me that communism's dead. Number seven. Has your news media reported to you the dissolution of the state-created corporations in the USSR, or that they no longer regulate the people's use of their own land? Remember, that called for the extension of factories and instruments of production owned and controlled by the state? Remember, that's the seventh plank, corporations. Oh, no. No. I don't think we went back to private property in the Soviet Union or China. And we have adopted corporate capacity here in the United States. Number eight, did they tell you about Russian women being admonished by the state to rebuild the crumbling family unit and to reestablish the home as the principal haven and bulwark of child development? Did they repeal welfare, food stamps, and government control? This is getting to sound like a broken record. Remember that it calls for equal liability of all. Remember, equal liability of all to labor. That's Social Security, boys and girls. That's the state controlling your right to work. Number nine, perhaps they explained how they had halted the corporate takeover of family farms. Nor are you sure they're not asleep at this news time. Remember the combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries? Don't we have a Department of Agriculture? Don't we have government control of our farms and our agricultural business? And then certainly, last but not least, did the news media here in America or anywhere in the world, in Canada, Australia, any of you people out there, have you heard anything about the plan to restore parental authority and responsibility to train up a child in the way it should go by closing all the state schools? Not that I know. I don't know of any country in the world that doesn't support the concept of state schools, public education. Do you? Now, if you look into the Constitution of the United States, you won't find any provisions in there for state schools or public education. Our founding fathers never created any such nonsense as that. All of our founding fathers were educated either at home, in homeschool, or in private schools, which was the model that we followed in the United States. Not public schools. Public schools is communism. Private schools and home education. That's the model that we follow in our Constitution. Well, we did follow in our Constitution. Ladies and gentlemen, I would submit to you that communism is not dead. It is alive and well everywhere in the world, including the United Nations. Now remember that two of these planks directly associate with the income tax. The second plank, which calls for a heavy progressive income tax, and the central bank, which is the fifth plank, which is the means by which we get paper money, the unjust weights and balances, to be taxed. Now, we've got to have a methodology to sidestep the property rights guaranteed in the Constitution of the United States, and that's where Social Security comes in. And there is a very unusual case called Schaefer versus Carter. And I think I'll skip ahead here to Schaefer versus Carter. And I'll read this to you. Decided back in, 1920. Old case. 252 U.S. 37 called Schaefer versus Carter. Here's the Supreme Court of the United States. They say income taxes are a recognized method of distributing the burdens of government. Favored because requiring contributions from those who realize current pecuniary benefits under the protection of the government, and because the tax may be readily proportioned to their ability to pay. Taxes of this character were imposed by several of the states at or shortly after the adoption of the federal constitution. Did you ever hear that statement before? Didn't you think that the income tax came about after the 16th Amendment? Now listen to your Supreme Court now. Taxes of this character were imposed by several of the states at or shortly after the adoption of the federal constitution. That was taken from the New York laws of 1778. In the report of Oliver Wolcott, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury to the Fourth Continental Congress in the second session of 1796. Boys and girls, by 1825, 25% of the states in the Union had an income tax. Income taxes are not new and novel. They've been around for thousands of years. Now, the rights of the several states to exercise the widest liberty with respect to the imposition of internal taxes always has been recognized in the decisions of this court. And it is obvious that it is an incident of sovereignty, and it's coextensive with that to which it is incident. All subjects over which the sovereign power of a state extends are objects of taxation. Now remember, we covered that in a little obscure case that nobody knows very much about, called Wickard versus Pilburn. Remember that? It's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Here's your Supreme Court in Schaefer versus Carter telling you the same thing. In 1920, it is obvious that it is an incident of sovereignty, and it's coextensive with that to which it is an incident. All subjects over which the sovereign power of a state extends are objects of taxation. So anytime you get a driver's license, marriage license, birth certificate, business license, anytime you sign a contract with the state so that you can get welfare, food stamps, any kind of largesse, any kind of covenant or contract with a foreign and alien god called government, you can be regulated, you can be controlled, and you can be taxed. The exception to that is property, property rights, and sovereign common law freemen, of which there are very, very precious few of those around. Now, 100 years ago, nearly everybody was. Everybody in 1900, just, you know, not everybody, but the majority, the vast majority of people here in the United States exercised common law freeman status. Something happened here in America, and I submit to you that something happened in Canada, something happened in Australia, New Zealand, and England, and France, and Germany, that changed that status. And how could they get us to adopt the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in place of the 10 commandments? You know, 100 years ago, people obeyed God and kept His commandments. Now, we've thrown the 10 commandments and God out of our public schools, which makes all the sense in the world. I don't think He belongs there in the first place. But that's a personal opinion, and I don't think the 10 commandments belong in a whorehouse. And if they don't belong in a whorehouse, they certainly don't belong in public school, do they? I can readily understand why the state wants to abolish the 10 commandments in public school. Now, there's another factor that comes into play here. There's a clear distinction between the common law and the civil law, and I think that it's incumbent upon us to understand it. The income tax, Social Security, and connecting links with the common law and the civil law. Here's the way this works. The common law is predicated upon the Ten Commandments, which is construed by statutes and judgments, and enforced by ordinances, which we commonly call penalties today. Well, the Roman civil law works on four principles, that is, a constitution construed by statutes and court decisions, and it's enforced by penalties. And so, the common law is the Ten Commandments, and the opposite to that is a civil constitution. The Ten Commandments are construed by statutes, and the Constitution is construed by statutes. And it's also construed by judgments, and the civil law is construed by court decisions. The common law is enforced by ordinances, and the civil law is enforced by penalties. Ordinances and penalties are the same thing. Judgments and court decisions are the same thing. Statutes and statutes are the same thing. The Ten Commandments and the Constitution are the same thing. But boys and girls, the Constitution and the Ten Commandments don't say the same thing. And the principles that are construed by these two systems of government are at opposite ends of the pole. Now, there are two distinct forms of law here on planet Earth. The common law on the one hand, and the civil law on the other. Now, the civil law is bound up in the Constitution, statutes, judgments, and the penalty clauses of statutes by license and consent. Underline the word consent. Nobody stuck a gun to your head and forced you to get a marriage license. Nobody cunningly coerced you into going down and getting your Social Security number, which is your taxpayer identification number. There's nobody that forces or compels you to get a business license or make application to the state to get, you know, land subsidies or farm subsidies. You do that voluntarily, boys and girls. The government holds it out to you, just like Wickard versus Filburn says, here, come and get it. You want to eat at the public trough with everybody else? That's a choice for you to make. You know, the common law is ancient, and it's bound up in the Ten Commandments, the statutes, judgments, and ordinances, commonly called the Law of Moses. The common law is predicated upon rights, and it's based upon individual responsibility, inalienable rights, and property. Now, the civil law, on the other hand, is predicated upon franchise. and it's based upon privileges, limited liability, also known as insurance, and equitable interest. We call those stocks. So the common law is based upon land, labor, and substance, and the civil law is based upon contract over time for profit and gain. The common law is based upon rights which require damage to someone's life, liberty, or property to constitute a crime. The civil law is based upon privileges which require acts or omissions upon statutes with penalties to protect a public interest. Now, there's your two branches of law. And, of course, you have a right to make a choice as to what law you want to practice. Now, there's another facet or factor that comes into this, and it's called the guardian-ward relationship. Guardian and ward. Listen to this. From American Jurisprudence, 39 Amgeer 2nd, Section 1, page 9. As it relates to the guardian and ward, trust relation between guardians and ward, the definition and nature, a guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character. There's that sacred again. Sacred. In which one person who is called a guardian acts for another called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. A guardian-ward relationship. And the ward is unable to manage his own affairs. Think about that now for a moment. The purpose of statutes relating to guardianship is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons, and the court should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. All right, now tuck that one away in your heart, boys and girls, because an officer of the court, a guardian, is an officer of the court, and the judge is the superior guardian. In Section 22, the appointment of a conservator, in several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he is incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, or he may request, or he may simply consent to the appointment of a conservator, a guardian of his estate or of his person or both, who, when appointed, possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as a guardian of an incompetent. Underline the word incompetent. Boys and girls, when you go down and sign up for a marriage license, you declare yourself to be an incompetent, unable to manage your marital affairs, for which you need social lady to guide and direct you. Ladies and gentlemen, when you go down to get a business license, you declare yourself to be a business incompetent, incapable and unable to conduct your business affairs, for which you need a guardian to guide your business affairs for you. When you go down and sign up for a checking account, you declare yourself to be a fiscally incompetent, unable to manage your money, for which you need a guardian to manage and to help direct you in the management of your money. Ladies and gentlemen, when you go down and sign up for Social Security, you declare yourself to be an incompetent, unable to manage your life or your affairs, for which you need a guardian, the government, to come in and manage your affairs for you. You can't take care of yourself in your old age. If you break your leg, you can't take care of that on your own. If you become unemployed, you're not able to find a job, you need help. Now, I don't deny that there are a lot of incompetent people. Jesus said, the poor you have with you always. We have never construed the poor to be competent people. If they were competent, they wouldn't be poor. But we also construed wealthy people or people with means as being competent. Why is it that the wealthiest nation on earth, past tense, because we're no longer wealthy, we are now all judgment debtors, but Americans used to be in the wealthiest nation on earth. If we, in fact, were Americans and wealthy, why on earth did we need all these guardians? When you hire an attorney, you declare yourself to be legally incompetent, unable to manage your legal affairs, for which your lawyer comes in and represents you. Why are you legally incompetent? Why are you fiscally incompetent? Why are you educationally incompetent? Why are you incompetent to manage your own business? Have you ever thought about perhaps regaining your capacity? Again, here's what a guardian ward relationship is. A guardian is a person who is the guardian over the person who is a ward. The ward is the person who is incompetent and unable to manage his affairs, for which he has a guardian and the judge in the court. And the judicial system is the superior guardian, and your guardian is an officer of the court. That's why they always take you into court when you don't pay your taxes. They take you into court, and they're going to punish you. They're going to put you in jail for not filing your tax return or for cheating on your taxes, evading your taxes. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, I mentioned that corporate capacity or a contract with the state puts you in a state jurisdiction, a civil law jurisdiction. The income tax applies to people who have a contract, who have an agreement to pay that tax, who receive benefits granted by the state. The state gives you these benefits. It gives you these franchises for which the state cuts off a chunk of this joint venture. Remember that story? And when we're talking about search and seizure, that's a protection that we get from the Bible. It's a protection that is incident to privacy. It is incident to personal responsibility. And in seeking a rationale for the validity of the search, in this case, called Almeida Sanchez, The government thus understandably sidesteps the automobile search cases, and instead the government relies heavily on cases dealing with administrative inspections. But these cases fail to support the constitutionality of the search. Well, a Mexican fellow with a green card is 30 miles inside the United States driving a pickup at 2 o'clock in the morning. The pickup is loaded with marijuana. And as he's driving down the road, two Border Patrol agents who are in their car at an intersection, which is well lighted, observe Mr. Sanchez driving through the intersection. One says to the other, "Look at that. A Mexican at 2 o'clock in the morning, 30 miles from the Mexican border. Therefore, he must be a criminal. Let's go check him out." Well, in a case called Camera versus Municipal Court, cited at 387 U.S. 523, the court held that the administrative inspections to enforce community health and welfare regulations could be made on less than probable cause to believe that particular dwellings were the sites of particular violations. Yet the court insisted that the inspector obtain either consent or a warrant supported by particular physical and demographic characteristics of the areas to be searched. Now, the search in this present case, Almeida Sanchez, was conducted in the unfettered discretion of the members of the Border Patrol who did not have a warrant, who did not have probable cause, who did not have consent. And the search thus embodied precisely the evil the court saw in Camera when it insisted that the discretion of the official in the field be circumscribed by obtaining a warrant prior to this inspection. And there are two other administrative inspection cases that have been relied upon by the government in this case, which are equally in opposite. The first is called Colonnade Catering Corporation versus United States, and the second is United States versus Biswell. Both of these cases approved warrantless inspections of commercial enterprises engaged in businesses closely regulated and licensed by the government. In the Colonnade case, the court stressed the long history of federal regulation and taxation of the manufacture and sale of liquor. And in the Biswell case, the court noted the pervasive system of regulation and reporting that is imposed upon licensed gun dealers. But a central difference between those cases and this case of Almeida Sanchez is that businessmen who are engaged in such federally licensed and federally regulated enterprises accept the burdens as well as the benefits of their trade. Whereas the petitioner here, in this case, Almeida Sanchez, was not engaged in any regulated or licensed business. The businessman, in a regulated industry, in effect, consents to the restrictions that are placed upon him. Now, did you get the import of that? A Mexican hauling marijuana is not licensed, bonded, and insured, and hasn't consented to the waiver of his Fourth Amendment rights. Now, one time I had an OSHA inspector come into my factory, and then, you know, I went to public school. And I gotta admit, I wasn't the sharpest marble in the drawer. In fact, I think I was just about as dumb as a box of rocks. And this OSHA guy came in, little Japanese fellow. And I'm not really opposed to Japanese. I don't want you to think I'm totally racist. But little Japanese guy came in. And he announced that he was there to conduct an inspection of my factory. Now, I went to public school, and I thought that I had some kind of Fourth Amendment rights. Now, I've got to remember, the Atlantis Manufacturing Company is licensed, bonded, insured, and incorporated. But it was mine. You know, well, not all. I owned 50% of the stock. you know, was a stock company. And there were other investors, of course, but I was the CEO, you know. I was the chairman of the board of directors. And I thought that there was something to do with private property and rights and Fourth Amendment and Bill of Rights and Constitution. So anyway, I said, "Nah, you can't come in here and search. You got to go get a search warrant." And he kind of raised his voice, and I kind of raised my voice, and I threw him out. And our relationship—that is, George Gordon's relationship with government—never been quite the same since. And I learned to my chagrin that he didn't need a warrant. You see, when I incorporated that business, I waived my Bill of Rights. I wanted privilege from government. I wanted limited liability. And the government gave me those privileges. They gave me those franchises and retained the capacity to search, to regulate, to control, to tax. I didn't know that. Well, I do now, but you know, I didn't then. So I was really bummed out, but I'm not anymore. See, that's public business. And then I said, well, then if I don't have any rights, and if I can be regulated, controlled, and taxed in this public business, what do I need to do to get out from under that? So I got to searching around, and there's this obscure old-timey case. Old-timey case. And it's called Hale versus Hinkle. Write this down. It's 201 U.S. 43. 201. That's volume 201 of the U.S. Supreme Court reports. Page 43. 201 U.S. 43. Now, turn to page 74. That's what you want to read. The background of the case is fairly simple. The American Tobacco Company, you know, the good fellows that make Lucky Strike cigarettes. 1905 is the year, and the IRS has issued an administrative subpoena to the American Tobacco Company, and they said, "Now listen, bring in your records and books because we want to audit this corporation." The company controller says, "Not by the hair on my chinny chin chin, you got to get a warrant. You have to have a search warrant. We're protected. We've got rights." Well, the case wound its way up to the United States Supreme Court. And so in 1905, the Supreme Court comes down and says, okay, well, let's talk about this corporate capacity and rights and individuals and their rights. And let's see how these rights need to be construed. The Supreme Court speaking, they said, conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation, and that the officer of the corporation was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation which, with respect to the production of its books and papers, we are of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation. Did you get that? I underlined it. There is a clear distinction between an individual and a corporation. An individual who might have some rights and a corporation which may or may not have some rights. And that the latter, the corporation, has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. Did you get that? Let me read it again. The latter, the corporation, has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. And many, many times, people call the law school and they say, the IRS wants my books and papers, and they didn't give me a warrant. They don't need one. You've got a social security number, don't you? I've seen this played out numerous times in federal court where people, in good faith, come in and say, well, where are my rights? You don't have any. Well, I'm an American. Well, of course you are, but you're incompetent. You're an incompetent American. You declared yourself to be incompetent and unable to manage your financial affairs when you got a Social Security account. You declared publicly, I can't take care of myself when I get to be 65 years old. When I'm unemployed, I can't take care of myself and find another job. I need unemployment insurance. And the government came in and said, okay, sign here. And when you're unemployed, we'll find you a job or we'll give you unemployment insurance. But, of course, that costs money and we got to tax you. That's why we have unemployment tax. That's why we have Medicare tax. You see, Americans are unable to take care of their health. They get sick all the time. Because they get sick, they have to be taken care of. And it costs a lot of money to be taken care of. And so these same people who get sick, can't take care of themselves, have to have insurance. And you hear this all the time. Government comes along, they say, 45 million Americans don't have health insurance. I'm one of them. George Gordon doesn't have any health insurance. I avoid health insurance like I avoid whores, AIDS, and communists. But my government keeps branding me and they say, oh, that guy Gordon, he doesn't have health insurance. I don't have Social Security checks coming in either. I don't need them. I can take care of myself without Social Security. And I can take care of my own body, and I can take care of my own health without health insurance. I don't need a doctor. I don't need a hospital. I don't need welfare, food stamps. Now, if you need welfare and food stamps, and if you need health insurance and doctors, I don't find fault with you. I'm not sitting here criticizing you, but listen. Listen. Wake up. If you need somebody to act as your guardian and provide medical services for you, you should not think it a thing strange that somebody's going to tell you when to get up in the morning, when to go to bed at night, and what to do in between. You shouldn't think it a thing strange, then, that your guardian is going to come to you and say, we're going to have to take some deductions out of your paycheck every month to pay for this health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. You know, people need to pay that 16% tax on Social Security for those 108 benefits that you receive from the government. Now, if you want those 108 benefits, then sit down, shut up, and pay for them. I just happened to be one of the guys that didn't want the benefits, and so I waived the benefits, dropped out of the program, and I don't participate. And I'm not entitled to Social Security checks every month. I don't want them, not entitled to them, didn't pay for them, and I don't receive them. I figured that I could do a better job taking care of myself. Now, not everybody can do that, and I recognize that. And I'm not angry with anybody, and I'm not getting mad, but, you know, people call me here at the law school, and they just get really upset, and they say things like, I live in the People's Republic of Michigan, and look what these public officials are doing to me in Michigan. So I thought, well, let me explain to you why your public officials in Michigan are doing all of these bad, nasty, wicked, awful, terrible things to you. They're doing this to you to protect and serve you. They're doing this for you because you're incompetent and unable to manage your own affairs. Now, let's picture this. Let's put you in a mental hospital. Let's suppose one day that you're not feeling too good. You walk into the local mental hospital, you know, Napa State Hospital or the Idaho State Mental Hospital, and you say, I'm not feeling too good today. And they say, well, here's a form. Can you fill this out and sign it? And so you fill out the form. You get down to the bottom and you sign it. You sign yourself into the mental hospital. And it's all free, and we take care of this with taxpayer expense, and you're declared to be an inmate of the hospital and incompetent and unable to manage your affairs, and some nice doctor comes over and he asks you some questions, and you lay down on the couch and they examine you and they poke you and they give you drugs and make you feel real good. Okay, now so after a while, you wake up one day and you say, well, gee, I'd like to leave here now. I'd like to leave. And so you just walk out to the gate. You say, hey, I'm leaving. And some guy grabs you, throws you into a straitjacket, locks you into a room and says, no, you don't understand this, son. You can't leave here without permission. And then you jump up and down and you say, well, wait a minute, I'm an American. I've got rights. No. Mental patients declared to be incompetent, in a mental hospital do not have any rights. At least they don't have any rights that they can assert or that they can declare. Your guardian can do that for you. That's the doctor, that's the hospital staff, that's the administration. They can assert rights for you. They can take care of you. They're there to protect and serve. They're there to protect you. That's what a guardian ward relationship is all about. Now, boys and girls, people with social security numbers, marriage licenses, business licenses, driver's licenses, maybe you're on WIC or welfare or aid to families with dependent children, or you're a farmer and you're signed up for some agricultural program. You have all declared yourselves to be incompetent and unable to manage your affairs in those areas of your life. And as a result of that, some nice government official, he may be a highway patrolman who is managing your affairs on the highways because obviously you're not capable or competent enough to buckle your seatbelt, drive on the right side of the road, drive within the speed limits, or register your car, or do those things, those 2,000 things that are required by the legislature, which is your guardian, making laws for you to protect your health, safety, and welfare. Or it may take the form of an IRS agent, a nice fellow who comes in and says, listen, I'd like to audit your books and make sure that you're paying all of the money that you owe for all of the services the government provides to you. Or maybe a social lady comes in and says, gee, I'd like to talk to your child, or I'd like to interview you concerning your child, and I would like to guide and direct your family and domestic affairs and tell you how to raise your child, how to educate your child, how to take care of your child. And sometimes people, they get upset with this. They get upset with social lady telling them how to discipline their child or how to educate their child. Now, social lady is a paid professional, educated in college, and she knows more about raising your child than you do, as evidenced by the fact that you got a marriage license and a birth certificate for the child and publicly declared that you were incapable of managing your own family and incapable of raising your own children. That's the legal effect of a marriage license and birth certificate. Don't get angry with social lady. She's there to protect and serve. Now, going on with Hale versus Henkel, they go on to, this is the Supreme Court now, they said that the individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He, the individual, is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. He, the individual, his power to contract is unlimited. The individual owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation, so far as it may tend to criminate him. He, the individual, owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom. Now, I'm going to underline this. Since he receives nothing therefrom. That's the key right there. Can you see that, boys and girls? If you receive nothing from the state, then you owe nothing to the state. That's why I'm so adamant about not having state Medicare. You know, they got all these old people now running down signing up for Medicare. Well, I didn't go down and sign up. And do you know why? Gee, I'm competent and capable of managing my own body. I really didn't want social lady or some nice person from the government telling me what I should or should not do, or when I should come in and when I should go out, or when I should get up and when I should go to bed, or what I should do in between. I thought I'd like to just decide that for myself. I know it's a wild new concept. Individual responsibility. Individuals deciding for themselves when they're going to get up in the morning, when they're going to go to bed at night, and what they're going to do in between, without any guardian, without any help from any outside source. It's a strange, wild concept. I don't deny it. So I don't receive anything from the state beyond the protection of my life and property. And the individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land. Now, the law of the land, boys and girls, is the common right, common law. So his rights, the individual's rights, are such as existed by the common law long antecedent to the organization of the state. You know, the law of Moses was here and in full force and effect before the state of Wisconsin, or Florida, or Michigan, or the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Did you know that? Just thought I'd share it with you. Long antecedent to the organization of the state and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. Now, you know, Almeida Sanchez had constitutional rights because he wasn't licensed, bonded, or insured. But if you've got a, you know, an alcohol license, or you've got a gun license, hey, children, don't get mad at the inspectors who come in to regulate and control you. And right about here, somebody says, well, I have to get a license. I can't make a living without it. I don't deny that. I'd be the last guy to come along and deny that. Most of you people listening to my voice right now are incompetent, and you cannot make a living without government. I can, and I do. There are a few people who can, and they do. 100 years ago, your great-grandfather could, and he did. And over the past 100 years, Americans have become a nation of incompetent people who were unable to make a living without government guidance. But would you like to learn how to make a living without government guidance? Would you like to learn how to live your life without a guardian? That's the essence of freedom. It's called responsibility. You can't have freedom divorced from responsibility. If you can't govern yourself, then somebody has to govern you. You know, when you got a kid, throws himself on the floor, kicks and screams, having an apoplectic fit, a little kid, 5 years old, needs guidance and direction. This kid is not somebody that you want to put a gun in his hand and send him outside to play. He can't control his emotions. He can't control the gun. He's out of control, and he needs a guardian. That's why we have mommies and daddies, and social ladies, and school teachers. Now, when the little boy grows up and gets some years and experience behind him, and he gets to a point where he can govern himself, he can control his emotions. Gee, maybe he might be a candidate for a gun. Gosh, maybe this kid might be a candidate for some freedoms and responsibilities in life. And that's what freedom is all about. And that's why George Washington said that the concept of trying to govern without morality is preposterous. The Constitution of the United States, boys and girls, was designed for a moral people. And he who is governed best is governed least. And to be governed least, you have to govern yourself. After all, that's what freedom's all about. And you can't govern yourself with a guardian. Yeah, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to leave it here, and we'll take it up right here with Hale versus Hinkle next time. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and or The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.